Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. We always start out with some debt-related news and facts for the week from Reuters. Wall Street critic Elizabeth Warren said on Friday last week she accepted the job of setting up a Consumer Financial Protection Agency for U.S. President Barack Obama and declared that the time for financial tricks and traps was over. Obama expected to announce his appointment of Warren, a Harvard University professor and hero to liberal activists, taking a step forward in enacting the financial reform that is a signature achievement of his presidency. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is Warren's brainchild, will have broad powers to write and enforce regulations covering mortgages, credit cards, and other financial products. Warren is reviled by many on Wall Street for her calls to crack down on abusive lending practices by financial firms. Warren will not be in charge of directing the agency once it is formally set up. By selecting her as an advisor rather than as the agency head, Obama sidestepped the congressional confirmation process, which Republicans could have used to thwart Warren's nomination. Warren said in a blog post on the White House website that she had enthusiastically agreed to take on the role. "The president and I are committed to the same vision on CFPB, and I am confident that I will have the tools I need to get the job done," she said. "The new law creates a chance to put a tough cop on the beat and provide real accountability and oversight of the consumer credit market. The time for hiding tricks and traps in the fine print is over." The White House hopes Warren's appointment will energize supporters from the president's liberal base ahead of November 2nd elections across the nation that are expected to produce victories and possible congressional majorities for Republicans. She will become assistant to the president and special advisor to Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. Warren will play the lead role in setting up the bureau and ensuring it is as effective as possible, a White House official said. She will also advise the president on policies and programs that are designed to protect the financial interests of middle-class families. Obama, a Democrat, will use the announcement to draw attention to financial regulation reform, legislation that Republicans largely opposed and voters largely ignored as they fret over a rough economy and near double-digit unemployment. "Never again will folks be confused or misled by the pages of barely understandable fine print that you find in agreements for credit cards, mortgages, and student loans," Obama was to say, according to the excerpts of his remarks. Basically, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau will be a watchdog for the American consumer, charged with enforcing the toughest financial protections in history. Obama has made improving the lives of the middle class a central theme of his efforts to support Democratic candidates and lawmakers ahead of the November elections, drawing contrast with Republicans, who he says favor the rich when it comes to financial and tax policies. Enacting the broad financial reform law, including the establishment of the consumer agency, is part of that strategy he hopes will resonate with Americans. "If the CFPB can succeed at leveling the playing field, we can go a long way toward repairing a gaping hole in the budgets of millions of families," Warren said in the blog. But nobody has ever thought or argued that the Consumer Bureau can fix everything. Lost jobs, stagnant incomes, rising costs for college, dwindling retirement savings. There's a lot of work to be done. It is unclear how long Warren will stay in her job establishing the agency. The Treasury, which is mandated to set it up, must lay out a timetable soon for how long that will take. And from truthout.org, Can Elizabeth Warren Save the Economy? By Zach Carter. President Barack Obama's decision to appoint Elizabeth Warren to set up the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau couldn't have come at a more critical time. Over 44 million Americans were living in poverty last year. That's the highest number on record. The Great Recession is taking a terrible toll on everyone outside the executive class, but policymakers have been reluctant to pursue an economic agenda that improves the lives of ordinary Americans. The uniqueness of Warren's new post raises plenty of questions, but it puts a fierce defender of the middle class in office at a time when the middle class most needs help. So what exactly will Elizabeth Warren do? As Annie Laurie emphasizes for the Washington Independent, it's not entirely clear what Warren's new job will be or how long she will have it. Consumer advocates have pushed hard to get Obama to name Warren the first director of the new CFPB. Obama, citing Senate confirmation hurdles, has instead charged Warren with setting up the agency as an advisor to both the Treasury Department and Obama himself. The post allows Warren to get to work setting up the agency, but not the power to start drafting regulations. It's good to see her get a post on the Obama team, but we do not yet know how influential she will be. Tim Fernholz sums up the pros and cons of Warren's appointment in a piece for the American Prospect. There are very real drawbacks to the move. Confirming Warren for a permanent post as director of the CFPB will be harder next year. Democrats are likely to lose Senate seats in November. It's not impossible, but if confirmation was Obama's chief worry, he's only made it harder on himself by kicking the nomination down the road. This is true for whoever Obama picks. The bank lobby is going to scream about anybody other than a bank lobbyist, and Republicans are filibustering almost everybody Obama nominates to any post, including critical economic policy positions at the Federal Reserve. But the new role gets Warren on the economic policy team right away and allows the agency to begin staffing up under her stewardship, even if it can't draft regulations until a permanent director has been confirmed. There will finally be a strong voice on Obama's economic team, prioritizing household financial security above all else. That's very good news. Whatever the formal powers of Warren's new post, we can be sure she'll have a significant impact on policy making. Her current role as chair of the oversight panel for the Wall Street bailout was given almost no power at all by Congress, yet Warren has transformed it into the only real source of economic accountability in Washington, D.C. That's no easy task, and we can expect similar courage and creativity from her as a member of Obama's economic team. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So, continuing the article, what will the CFPB look like? Warren herself seems to be pleased with the appointment. In a piece for Alternet, Warren says that she enthusiastically agreed to take on the new position and explains the vision for the CFPB. The new Consumer Bureau is based on a pretty simple idea. People ought to be able to read their credit card and mortgage contracts and know the deal. They shouldn't learn about an unfair rule or practice only when it bites them, way too late for them to do anything about it. The new law creates a chance to put a tough cop on the beat and provide real accountability and oversight of the consumer credit market. That sounds common sense, but it's exactly opposite to the past three decades of deregulation. Reversing the damage caused by the anti-regulatory fervor has been extremely difficult. The Obama administration needs Warren's voice now more than ever. In the early day of his presidency, Obama pushed through a stimulus plan that has prevented the middle class from falling completely off the map. But those efforts are expiring, and they haven't been enough to prevent millions of families from sinking into poverty. And in fact, the poverty rate is alarming. In a harrowing piece for The Nation, Kai Wright notes that more people are now impoverished than at any time since the government began tracking poverty data. The poverty rate rose to 14.3%, with 44 million Americans, roughly 1 in 7, living in poverty. More than 1/3 of Black and Latino children are growing up impoverished. So it's no surprise that income inequality is also at its most severe in decades. As Kevin Drum notes for Mother Jones, for the past 30 years, more and more American wealth has been concentrated among the richest citizens. The richest 1% of U.S. earners are ranking in 10% more of the national income today than they were at the start of the Reagan administration, while the poorest 95% have seen their share of the national income decline. Numbers like these aren't a fluke. They are a direct result of policies that put the interests of Wall Street and other powerful corporate players ahead of the well-being of households. Nor were these policies adopted in a vacuum. Wall Street lobbied hard for the right to pillage our pocketbooks, and when it couldn't rewrite the rules, it simply broke them, while bank-friendly regulators looked the other way. Elizabeth Warren can't fix all of this on her own, and she'll surely face opposition from some members of Obama's inner circle. But families couldn't ask for a better advocate, and her appointment couldn't come at a better time. And that's from truthout.org. So for those of you who listen to Life in Debt and have been doing so for over 2 years now, everyone knows that I am an avid Elizabeth Warren fan. And much of what I present on this show is actually part and parcel with her genius, her thinking, her middle class values and assertion of those. And recently we have been looking at her book, The Two Income Trap, Why Middle Class Parents Are Going Broke. It's by Elizabeth and her daughter, Amelia Warren Tyagi. And I start with the credit that the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend that you read their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. You can also go to the website archives at www.kruufm.com. under Life and Debt, and you can listen to all of the shows that we have produced to help you deal with really challenging problems regarding debt. Recently, we've been talking about the financial fire drill, and then went over to, well, what if the house is already on fire in terms of finances? Last week, we discussed one option is rather than having a two-income family, we have a stay-home person, which means basically should you or your spouse quit your job and stay at home so you won't be in any danger of falling into the two-income trap. If you're like millions of parents, you are already up to your eyeballs in mortgage payments and tuition bills, and pulling out of the workforce will only make things worse. And in fact, the economy at large has set itself up over the last generation to almost force people to be in the two-income situation for bare necessities. It is possible for some people to do that. For some families, it's the worst idea possible, but for others, it is a good idea, financially speaking. It would be a good solution if you could afford it. If you would prefer to have a parent at home full-time, but were afraid that it would be too risky economically, then don't worry, though. The idea that it takes two incomes to be financially secure is dangerously wrong-headed. As we've gone over the data in Professor Warren's book, it showed that a family with a stay-at-home parent has an important source of economic security as a backup earner and caregiver who can step in if anything goes wrong. So as long as you can challenge the system and get by a single income and the stay-at-home parent can enter the workforce if the need arises, which presumes that one is keeping up with one's skills and one's education, etc., then go right ahead and quit the job. But the bottom line, too, is that many people actually prefer to work now, and they could be two parents in the same family. So by all means, just do it. Two earners does not mean an inevitable dive into the two-income trap. It just means there is more risk, and the family must plan accordingly. The financial planning books typically treat one and two income families the same, telling you to add up your family's income, divide by the expenses, and fill in the blanks. But as we've shown, they are not the same. Without a safety net, your two income family must be careful not to budget as tightly as a one income household. If at all possible, think of that second income as a safety net, a special reserve for bad times. When times are good, put something in savings. Definitely put something in savings. And spend the rest of the second paycheck on your wants, what you like, what you want to do with extra money. Go to restaurants, nice clothes, treats for the kids, and treats for yourself. But those are cash-only treats, not taking out debt by using your cash to get the ball rolling, for example, to buy an expensive item, television, that you will then pay for the balance over time. That's not what we're talking about here. These are current cash transactions. The two-income trap would mean that you're needing both incomes to pay for the mortgage, the health insurance, the car payments, those long-term debt loans that you have. But if you can get away with that second income and enjoy the benefits of having two incomes while staying secure, then that's fine. Two people working is not really the bottom of the analysis. It's what you do with the money, where it's allotted, towards necessities or towards wants. If it has to go to the necessities, then obviously one cannot leave the second job and stay at home, but one has to recreate the budget and, as we've discussed in great detail, the balance of the formula for necessities, wants, and savings. So, for example, if the necessities are high because the mortgage is too high, as we've discussed, it may mean you're in the wrong house and you need to get out of it by buying down or just selling and paying rent every month. That's just an example. But that's the kind of issue that comes up with these formulaic setups in your budget. Now, the other thing that was proposed is to get out of the two-income trap, don't have any children. Now, that's a solution. Many women have found that as a way to avoid the two-income trap. It doesn't involve loading up on insurance policies or conducting a financial fire drill, nor does it require you to keep a spouse at home full-time. And unlike the other solutions that we've presented, it is cost-free and, from an economic point of view, it's highly effective. The solution is, in some respects, part of, if not the major cause of the problem. More mouths to feed, more responsibilities, more things that can get out of one's hands and control, sickness, accidents, and then, of course, the needs and necessities and wants and desires of the kids as they grow up. Tuition and coaching, camp, etc., etc. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So back to not having children as a solution to the two-income trap. Professor Warren points out that childlessness may not be a calculated economic strategy, but it has powerful economic consequences. By foregoing childbearing, a woman decreases her chances of going bankrupt by 66%. She reduces the likelihood that she will ever deal with a collection call or worry about a repo man, and she increases the chances that she will hold on to her home. And this improved financial security will last a lifetime. By remaining childless, a woman greatly improves her odds of having a comfortable retirement. And this is all based on statistical data. A few generations ago, advising a woman not to have children would be ridiculous, perhaps even sacrilegious. Not only would it have defied the social norms of the time, which assumed that everyone would become parents, but the advice would have been viewed as economically self-destructive. At one time, men and women viewed children as economic assets. Some of us can actually remember this. Youngsters lent a hand on the farm or in the shop. They looked after their younger siblings, and most important, they cared for their aging parents. And this is really a traditional historical truth in most cultures. But it was here in the United States for quite a while also. That's why parents were expected to shoulder the cost of bringing up those children. After all, parents reaped the rewards. Now, if we look at children today, they're still economic assets. Today's children will build the economy of tomorrow, defend the nation in future wars, care for the sick, construct new buildings, repair the roads, and support the next generation of elderly through Social Security, if that all continues to work. But there is a key difference. These benefits are more abstract in a way. They go to society at large, and they're not specific to individual parents. Also, most of the contributions from today's children will not occur until they have grown up and left the home. So that's down the pike. In the modern economy, few children earn their keep by sweeping out the family store or gathering the next harvest. Although here in Iowa, there is a fair amount of that still going on. Most kids will be a financial burden well into adulthood. In just a few generations, the calculus of raising children has changed dramatically. Middle-class parents are investing more and more in their own children. At the same time, society at large claims an ever-growing share of the rewards of those investments. Bringing up children can seem like a financially crummy bargain. But Professor Warren underlines that signing on to have children is quite different from buying a high-priced consumer item with or without warranty. If having children were like buying a Mercedes-Benz with a preset tag that could be clearly accounted for, then prospective parents could make the usual set of financial choices posed by the typical economic textbook. They could choose among several options of vehicles, several models, or, in this case, the pleasure of a tiny new person. Reasonable people could make informed choices depending on their preferences, and they could abandon or resell their purchases if the costs got out of hand. But that's not true with the child. The cost of the child is not neatly packaged. It's not possible to calculate the 18-year or 22-year price tag of an individual person with her unique talents and her needs, and all this before she's even conceived. Whoever budgets for a baby with asthma package or a costly diploma at a private institution for the kid package, as parents, we make this commitment long before we know the full price. And this commitment colors the parents' financial prospects for the rest of our lives. For a growing number of Americans, childlessness has become a serious option. Much has been made of the possibility of a looming shortfall in the birth rate in America. Over the past 30 years, the proportion of childless women has doubled, and demographers predict that as many as a quarter of today's young women will never have children. And if the word gets out that families with children are nearly 3 times more likely to collapse into bankruptcy, the question then becomes, will even more women decide not to have children? And what about the children who grow up today watching mom and dad work hard all day, only to weep in frustration when bill collectors call them ugly names or repo men circle the family car? Will these kids have any interest in becoming parents themselves? Professor Warren concludes that her crystal ball is cloudy, and it is quite possible that the biological drive to pass on our genes will continue to win out over seemingly more rational financial calculations. And as human beings, we certainly hope so, not just for sentimental reasons, but also for economic ones. Many view parenthood as nothing more than another lifestyle choice, not so different from joining a commune or developing a passion for windsurfing. And that may be true from the perspective of an individual choosing whether or not to have a child, but it is not true for society at large. What happens to a nation that rewards the childless and penalizes the parents? If middle-class men and women stop making that parental lifestyle choice, who will care for them in their old age? Who will pay taxes, build infrastructure, and keep the economy afloat? And most important, who will populate the great middle class in America's future? Professor Warren says she wishes she could offer some clever advice that would tell everyone how to sidestep the financial landmines associated with parenthood, but she and Amelia cannot. The financial fire drill can help curb at least a few of the dangers of modern economic life, but it cannot negate the fundamental fact that having children has become an enormously risky undertaking. Nor can the financial fire drill protect an individual parent from the vagaries of the marketplace. So long as the only way parents can guarantee a decent education for their children is to buy an overpriced home in the suburbs, families will continue to take on ruinous mortgages. So long as the cost of preschool remain a family's responsibility rather than a public duty, parents will continue to struggle. So long as colleges can get away with doubling tuition every generation to pay for sports teams and armies of new administrators, families will be stretched even further. And so long as Congress refuses to impose some basic interest rate regulations, credit card companies and mortgage lenders will continue to drain tens of billions of dollars out of the pockets of middle-class American families each year. So her advice is born out of hope rather than sound financial reasoning. If you feel called to be a parent, we hope you will follow your heart. You may lose your home and you may go bankrupt. We hope the joys will outweigh the financial pain. And besides, what other advice would you expect from Elizabeth and Amelia, who are two working mothers who believe in the great American middle class and who pray for its strong future? But if you become a parent, they believe that you have an extra duty beyond providing for your child's needs. You also have a duty to speak up. Their book, The Two-Income Trap, and its data show that families cannot protect themselves alone. You need to write your representatives in Congress, petition your school board, and you need to speak out. There are 63 million parents in America, and with them, you are strong enough to make a difference. If you are to survive financially, you and other parents must band together for change. The survival of your interest group, parents, depends on it. And I will continue on this journey next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com.
100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.